Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza, an allied healthcare professional with over 25 years of experience. My career has primarily spanned private physical therapy and public school athletics. Driven by curiosity and a passion for the industry, I created the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast to explore the ever-evolving landscape of healthcare with a focus on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we'll dive into the challenges healthcare professionals encounter and discuss how collaboration can enhance understanding within the industry. Our goal is to improve the experience for patients and athletes alike. Now, on to the show.
On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, I'd like to welcome Dr. Bill Meehan. Bill is the director of the McKaley Center for Sports Injury Prevention and the director of research for the Brain Injury Center of Boston Children's Hospital, as well as the principal investigator of the neurological function across the lifespan, a longitudinal transitional study for former National Football League players, which is an NFL long study. He graduated from Harvard Medical School, where he's currently a professor of pediatrics and orthopedics. He conducts both clinical and scientific research in the area of sports injuries, particularly those of the brain and spine. His research has been funded by the National Institute of Health, the Center for the Investigation of Medicine and Innovative Technology, the National Football League Players Association, the National Football League, and the National Hockey League Alumni Association. He is the 2012 winner of the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine Award for Best Overall Research. He has multiple medical and scientific publications, is the author of the books Kids, Sports, and Concussion, a guide for coaches and parents in concussions, and is the co-editor of the book Head and Neck Injuries and Young Athletes. Now, on to the show.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast. This week, I have Dr. William Meehan III, who is the director at the McKaley Center for Sports Injury Prevention and the director of the research for the Brain Injury Center of Boston Children's Hospital. Dr. Meehan, welcome to the show. I appreciate you coming on today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this is good. We were commenting before about our headphones, and you made a great comment how you look like an air traffic controller, and I think that's kind of suiting. It'd be nice if you could change the backdrop to like Logan Airport.
Yeah, or something. I mean, that is kind of chaotic, isn't it?
It's good, though. You got a lot of stuff there. There's a good parabola behind you. I don't know what's happening back there, but
that's good. That's teaching distributions.
For nice.
The fellow learning research.
That's good. Can you give the audience a little background about you, how you got into medicine? I know you're a BC guy. Go Eagles, right? They pulled off a big win last week.
You're not kidding. Yeah, I missed it. I was also in a bit of mourning about Johnny Gaudreau, who.
It's sad.
It was a tough year, a tough time rather, and then a big win after it. So,
yeah, that is tough.
I am proud graduate of Boston College. Actually, now mostly I'm a husband. I'm a father to three fun loving kids, and we like to do stuff outdoors, fishing and hiking, hunting, camping, canoeing, that kind of stuff, and. I suppose I come from a large extended family, a really close-knit family. My dad was the oldest of nine. My mom was the oldest of five. And they all married and had kids. And I think I have 17 cousins.
Yeah.
And I have two in Massachusetts, one in Florida, and the rest all live within like 15 miles of where I grew up, and they hang out all the time. And so I'm sort of the
lone great.
Guy. Yeah, it's super fun. So.
Yeah, it's a big, you know, our family, same thing. My dad is one of eight. My mother was one of 12. So our Italian get-togethers are like the real Italian dinners when we used to all get together. Now, you're lucky if you can nail someone down for like a half hour, never mind a dinner.
Right, we're all over the place. It makes for fun gatherings, though.
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
Yeah.
You got into medicine after BC, right? Went to BC and...
Did yeah, I was an Irish studies and political science major at BC. I wasn't pre-med at all, and I sort of woke up when my junior year. I kind of realized I wanted to go into medicine, and I actually met with the pre-med advisor, but I was too far along. She's like, you know, you got to take calculus and four sciences plus four labs. You only got 2 years left. Like, there's just no way to fit it in your schedule. And at the time, I thought if you weren't pre-med undergrad, you couldn't go to med school. So I sort of was looking for other stuff. And then when I was out in the world, you know, people kept saying to me, you can go back to school and do it. But I thought they meant I would go to a community college and take those things. And then I was worried that the medical admissions office wouldn't take the grades from a community college, maybe. I just didn't know. But ultimately, a friend of mine who was a NICU nurse said, no, they have these programs specifically for people like you who are looking to go back. And she sort of put me onto it. And so I was working for Mayor Menino at the time in Boston. And I told him I wanted to go back. I studied and got in. And then that was it. So I did that at Tufts. I did the post-bac program at Tufts. I went to Harvard Medical School. And after that, I did an internship, a residency in pediatrics, a fellowship in pediatric emergency medicine, and then a fellowship in sports medicine. That's how I ended up here.
A lot of school.
Yeah, a lot of school.
A lot of fellowships.
A lot of school. I've been at Boston Children's a long time. Four years if you count my last 2 years of med school.
Yeah, yeah. It's good stuff. I mean, we're glad to have you. I think I've known you for quite a long time and bounced a lot of stuff off of you, and you've been a great resource. And that's why I think these conversations go a long way when it comes to getting people to understand what you do as a primary care sports med. People get confused by that. Like, well, what does that mean? Primary care versus surgical, right? So I think that's the big thing is understanding it.
It's true. Yeah. So, you know, in orthopedics, so actually sports medicine evolved out of family practice initially. This would have been around the 60s or 70s. And it was recognized that athletes sustain specific musculoskeletal injuries, but also you have to manage their diabetes or asthma or other conditions they have differently than you would manage non-athletes. And then around that same time in orthopedics, arthroscopic surgeries were developing. And after an arthroscopic procedure, you can usually get back to activity sooner. And so the two branches of sports medicine were sort of evolving side by side. And you could do, if you were an orthopedist, you could do a fellowship in sports medicine, which really was arthroscopy.
Yeah.
And if you were in pediatrics or internal medicine, family medicine, emergency medicine, et cetera, you could do sports medicine fellowship. And actually, Dr. McKaylee here at Boston Children's was one of the first people to say, well, why don't we put these two groups together? So typically, if you go a lot of other places, sports medicine is either in family medicine or in orthopedics, and they're really separate. Whereas here, he brought us all together, plus podiatry and registered dietitians and sports psychologists and everybody else. So
yeah,
sort of a unique model that I think now is catching on and spreading further throughout the country.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite genius because I think when I first met Dr. McKaylee, I was just started working for Carl back in 96, 97. And I was hired as an aide in the clinic, but then I was the athletic trainer for Emmanuel College in Boston Latin. And that's when I first met Dr. Demichord. He was my team physician.
Oh, sorry.
And that was kind of where it was taken off because I think Dr. McKaylee, Dr. Demichord, Dr. Jordan Metzel was there.
Sure, yeah.
He started, and then he went to New York.
That's right.
And then everybody else came along, right? So all those relationships started to build, and the thing took off. And I think that was, again, pretty genius, not being that understanding of the whole process of what he was trying to do. But again, I think he was kind of the engine in the front of the train, kind of making this what would be the better way to manage these type of injuries, but also the people that you're seeing every day.
Yeah. And in fact, he was the founder of the first pediatric sports medicine clinic in the country. It was 1974, which I'm going to guess you weren't born then.
I was a year old.
Yeah. I was three. So he had founded it then, and now it's just exploded. It really took off here. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing stuff. And I remember Carl introducing me to him back in the day, and he was such a big guy, and you're like, whoa, hey, Dr. McKaylee, how you? He's a big presence, right?
Right, yeah.
Still playing rugby then, and
I don't know
when he gave up rugby, but he was still playing when I met him. But definitely has been a great resource for us as well, just kind of the forefather of sports medicine, right?
I think that's right. Sure was, especially in pediatrics, yeah.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
What is your role, as the director of the McKaylee? Well, can you describe the McKaylee Center for Sports? I think the big thing is some people don't know what it is. Some people do, but I don't think they understand what's under the roof, right? So I think what is kind of the role? What do you do there? And what's the center all about?
Yeah. So about 15 years ago, Dr. McKaylee, for whatever reason, reread the original charter for the Division of Sports Medicine. He wrote in 1974. And in there, it said among the things we were going to do was preventing sports injuries. And he sort of said, if you see us because you're hurt, after we treat you, we sort of try to prevent re-injury. But we weren't doing a ton to stop injuries in the first place from people who we hadn't seen in clinic yet. And so he came up with the idea of that we should develop a center to do that. And before I was even a fellow, he started raising money to build the McKaylee Center. And at the time, they were looking for a director, and they didn't find what they were looking for. And I sort of ended up applying. I did not meet the qualifications in the description, but I felt like I could do it well, and ended up applying. And really, the idea was just, okay, prevent sports injuries, you know, hadn't been.
Right.
And so originally he said, listen, let's write a manual. So he assigned everybody either an injury or a sport and said, read all the literature with regards to that injury or sport and write a chapter about, you know, what are the risk factors for the injury? What is the evidence that you can prevent it? Of the risk factors that cause the injury, how many are modifiable? You know, you can't change your height, but maybe you could change some other things. And put it together in a book. And the idea was an athlete would come in and whoever the physician was on would read the book and then say, okay, measure the following things and then we'll try to change them. And that's how it was going to work. So when I became director, I sort of realized that's going to take forever. That's like a 10-hour appointment. You know, there's just no way they're exactly. going to read a whole chapter. And so one of the first people we hired was a computer programmer who wrote us some algorithms.
Okay.
And so the way it works now is the athlete comes to the center and they fill out a questionnaire and it tells us, you know, the sports they play, because that determines what injuries you're at risk for, the positions within the sport for some of those sports, injuries they've had in the past, stuff about their training regimen, their diet, other things that are associated, their sleep habits, things that are associated with risks of injury. And then they move out to the floor where our injury prevention specialists will measure their strength and flexibility, their functional movements, range of motion, balance, coordination, et cetera, for the sport. So what sport you play and what position within that sport determines what we measure. So for mm-hmm. a soccer player, we measure very different things than we do for a football player, a rugby player, something like that. And at the end of it, we can tell, you know, these are the injuries you're most likely to get based on all that information. And we can give the athlete a prescription for decreasing the risk of injuries. And a lot mm-hmm. of that has to do with changing their flexibility or their balance, strength, coordination, range of motion. Some of it is simply bracing, you know, some of it's easier to do. And then they could train at the center and do it. And that would be our big sort of signature thing. We also have evaluations for people who are just runners. They can get a gait evaluation for runners to see what's predisposing them to injury. For baseball pitchers, they can do a throwing evaluation to see. So that we have specific things. We have an ACL prevention program that just focuses on folks who don't want to tear their ACL. But the gist of it is you can come in, we can figure out what you're most likely to sustain and play in sports and then prevent it in the first place.
Yeah, it's great. When you guys were, you know, going through the process of developing this, I think I went to the opening when you guys opened the center, which, like you said, was about 14, 15 years ago. Yeah. And I think the people that were coming to the opening, it was pretty amazing because, like, nothing's been done like this, really. Realistically, unless you were going to, like, you know, you're an athlete trainer working in a big Division I college program or even professional program where they're doing a lot of the preventative stuff ahead of time, like your pre-participation physicals almost, right? The things we learned in undergrad as athletic trainers. So it's amazing to offer this to everybody so they understand, like, hey, this is what's out there to reduce. Because what parents want, they want their kids to be on the field playing. They don't want their kids to get hurt. And what's the best thing is try to reduce that by eliminating all of the factors that we can or possibly can't, because it's still going to be traumatic injury. You can't,
of course,
you know, you can't get rid of that, but
that's right.
We can work on, you know, you see that 13-year-old girl running down the basketball court that's like a baby giraffe, and you're looking at her like she's an ACL waiting to happen, right? So
yeah,
you're trying to eliminate that, right? So I think it's awesome that you guys, you know, had this, and then you've opened since then another center, right?
We did, and actually I misspoke a little bit. So 15 years ago they were raising money. 2010, I think we wrote the manual. We opened the doors to this place in 2013. Mm-hmm. And then we expanded to a second site in Norwood in October 2020. So in the middle of COVID, just after we were forced to close our center for 11 weeks because of the early COVID experience and stuff, we opened a second center. And it's now busier than our initial center. It's more popular than the initial center. It's bigger. It's newer, obviously. But And we... It takes a tremendous amount of effort. So I believe we are the only center in the world where an athlete can go and get an identified sort of unique prescription that addresses their specific risk factors. There's other sports injury research centers, but they focus on research, whereas we focus on research in addition to delivering prescription mm-hmm. for that client that's sort of unique to them. So Yeah, so I think we're the only place in the world. It's hard to confirm that, but we have not found another one by looking online and visiting.
That's pretty good. I think it's a great thing. Now, the research side of things, how much of that in your daily, I guess, description does that encompass you as a director, but also the center? Like, where does that lie with you guys?
It's a big part of it. So for me in particular, it's a big part. And we have a biomechanist here who will do the throwing evaluations. Mm-hmm. A large part of his time is spent doing research. We collaborate with all the physicians and surgeons in the division of sports medicine. So that's about 25 people, I think, at this point, on doing research. We have a research team with 4 research coordinators plus a research manager. And then we use all that data. So now we have data about all the measurements we took on the athletes, and we know what injuries they suffered in the past. Mm-hmm. So the ones that are already in the literature, that's why we're taking them. But we're taking certain measurements that may also be related to injury for a different sport that we just don't know yet because nobody's researched it. And so we've used that data to publish a bunch of papers identifying new risk factors. So it's a big part of what we do.
Yeah, it's pretty good stuff. The research always has intrigued me, but I think people to get the understanding that, hey, you're doing this as well to try to, you know, stay ahead of the curve, right? Instead of behind it. Like, kind of like I said earlier, like the engine, not the caboose. You know, you want to make sure you're ahead of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big part of working at Boston Children's and being at Harvard Medical School. You can't come here and just do what's standard. You sort of have to push the field forward if you're going to be here. And so for us, that's preventing sports injuries and also treating injuries differently. You know, there's a lot of innovations with regards to surgery and medical treatment for injuries and things like that. But the McKaley Center focuses on prevention.
Yeah. And then as far as staffing goes, I mean, if you look at, you know, the center, what's the ratio like ATs, PTs, sports scientists, you know, sports performance specialists, and then also primary care ortho, like what's that look like for you guys?
Big. So, you know, we have 11 physicians and surgeons that see patients at one of the McKaley centers in addition to at the hospital. We have 2 clinical psychologists, 2 athletic trainers who function clinically. I'll come back to that in a second. Mm-hmm. We have 4 physical therapists. We have 6 injury prevention specialists. And I think 5 of them are also athletic trainers.
Yep.
And all 6 of them are also certified strength and conditioning specialists. We have 4 that are just certified strength and conditioning specialists. We have a registered dietitian, mm-hmm. PA, a mental skills specialist, the biomechanist research team I told you about earlier.
Yeah.
We have an administrative director, 11 administrative staff, and then loads of collaborators from all over the hospital, not just in sports medicine, orthopedics, but really also in cardiology and endocrinology, rheumatology, other specialties as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty amazing. I mean, the size of the staff is amazing, and I'm sure it's still growing, right? So there's always room.
Sure.
Growth at some level, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's 25 physicians and surgeons in sports medicine. I said 11 because there's 11 that see patients here at the McKaley Center.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're all involved in our research and our education mission and everything else. So it's a really big effort. And it's fun that way. You know, we have a specialist at every, you can't name an injury or condition that we don't have a specialist for at Children's. It's really,
which is great. And I, you know, again, I said at the beginning of this, you know, I've utilized you guys a ton where direct access to these athletes is fantastic. Even if they're not coming over for preventative stuff, it's when there's an injury, you know, giving you a call or talking to someone in the office, hey, can you get somebody in that just had, you know, an ankle sprain or, you know, had a shoulder dislocation that's premature or skeletally immature and needs to get in? Can we get them in? And it's that day, next day, pretty quick, which a lot of us try to do. But with you guys being as busy as you are, you always try to, you know, make room for them, which is amazing.
We pride ourselves on it. In fact, years ago when I started the concussion clinic here, we kept track of that and we made sure we got everybody in within 2 weeks of them calling. And mm-hmm. most of the time, as you say, it'll be the same day or the next day. I mean, we really pride ourselves on that. And if ever we fall behind, we make efforts, open up Saturday clinics, start staying later into the evening, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I always thought I was special getting people in right away, but I know you do it for everybody.
We do what we can. Yeah, you're special anyway, Riz, but we do what
I know,
we can.
That's what everybody keeps telling me.
Yeah. We try to do it for everybody. It's true. Yeah.
How is the as far as the McKaley Center itself, we talked a little bit about Dr. McKaley and the sports medicine like book and what they wanted to do. Is there a direct connection or affiliation with Children's itself, or is it a separate entity? Like, how does that look? Because that's an interesting dynamic. You're on Children's property, but are you part of Children's Hospital?
It's funny. when you look at academic medical centers, when you've seen an academic medical center's structural hierarchy and staffing, you've seen one. They're all very, very different. And that's true at Boston Children's as well. So the way the McKaylee Center works technically is we were an initiative of the Children's Sports Medicine Foundation,
okay,
which is the organization that oversees the physicians, is made up of really the physicians that practice in the Division of Sports Medicine. And so when we opened up, we were a separate 501c3 from the hospital. We are the Children's Sports Medicine Foundation doing business as the McKaylee Center for Sports Injury Prevention. Still, obviously, all of us work at Children's, the doctors. Right. That's true for the staff in the McKaylee Center too. So when you come see one of our PTs or injury prevention specialists, they work at Boston Children's Hospital.
Okay.
When we see patients here, it is Boston Children's Hospital physicians seeing patients at the McKaylee Center. You know, it's not separate. We're on the ground. We pay them rent basically, but we use Children's Hospital software and computers and phones and everything. Yeah. So it's a super close relationship.
What do you like if you're thinking about patient care as a physician? What do you find that's intriguing or that really drove you towards adolescence versus adult care? Like, what was the big, like, defining moment for you? And does that still, you know, drive you daily with, you know, hey, what's around the corner? You talked about for a second, trying to be ahead of everything, right? You're always trying to be on the verge of new discoveries with research and being better at whatever you're providing now for prevention or if it's care. What was it about adolescence and what still drives you?
Yeah. You know, actually for me, I never considered doing an adult specialty. I was always going in pediatrics. And initially when I applied to medical school, my goal was to end up at Boston Children's Hospital and care for kids the whole time. And I first thought I was going to be a pediatrician. And when you do your residency, you rotate through all the different specialties. And so when I rotated through emergency medicine, I loved it. I mean, I just loved it. I was absolutely crazy about it. In fact, I traded all my sick call my junior and senior year. A sick call, you usually sit at home with somebody gets sick. I traded it all for emergency medicine shifts. I was and then when you do your emergency medicine fellowship, you have to rotate through sports medicine. So I never heard of sports medicine as a specialty until I rotated through it. And then I really liked that too. And so I ended up doing both for a while. And I was doing sports medicine clinics. I had ER shifts. I was doing clinical research, basic science research in a lab. And then when we opened the McKaylee Center, I just couldn't do it all. You know, you run out of time to do it all and do it well, really. And so at that point, I stopped doing emergency medicine. But I care both for kids and adults, by the way. So I do adolescents, I do young children, and I do adults. But you're right, the bulk of the practice is probably between the ages of 14 and 24 or something. And, in sports medicine, you know, most athletes, there's very few athletes younger than age 6. And there's few over than age 50. And so most of what you do is between 6 and 50. So you have to learn. If you're an internist, you got to learn about kids. And if you're a pediatrician, you got to learn about adults. But But I always wanted to do kids.
Yeah. I mean, that's what, you know, when I got into athletic training, that was my big thing. It was the rush of the emergency piece of it.
Yeah.
Like you said, the emergency care, it's like, how can you work on your feet quickly, fast, make the right decisions, care for the person. And then everything else kind of fell into place, right? You have the evaluative on field, you have the off field, you have the rehab, like all that stuff falls in. And I feel like working with the way I always looked at it, I would have maybe gone into collegiate or professional level sports at some point, but I felt one lifestyle is a difference, right? How you know, your lifestyle changes. You want to have a family, you want to have kids. It's definitely a challenge in that regard. But I feel like there's more influence at the younger ages, at least my perspective. So kids you're dealing with that are, you know, ninth to even into college. So 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, and into college, there's a lot of influence there. And I feel like that was kind of my calling. And that's what I like the best about it. And I feel like you guys are kind of in that same kind of wheelhouse, right? You're in that section of that sports medicine that there's more influence there, I feel. And that's what probably you might feel the same way.
I took it, you know, it's funny, growing up, like most of my life, it was just taken as a given that kids were more important than adults. You know, nobody ever talked about it. You just understood, like, kids are more important. You drive slower when there's kids around. You got to protect and take care of the kids. Don't let people pick on the kids, you know. And then when you go into medicine, the focus is really on adults. You know, it's like more attention paid toward adults. Most of what you learn in medical school is adult medicine. The reimbursements are higher for adults than kids. Like the whole thing, and it to me, it was just backwards. It was upside down. But I never cared to switch. It never occurred to me to do adult. It's always going to be about the kids. So yeah, like you,
which is good.
Important. Yeah,
we have a lot of years left, right?
You're not kidding.
Doing what we're doing,
and even in the research mode, you know, I spent a lot of my time studying former athletes, sort of guys my age and a little bit older. But the reason is to see, you know, if you get injured in sports as a kid, what happens long term? Is it beneficial for you to do sports, or is it negative, or are there trade-offs? You know, and that's most of what we look at.
You know, it's interesting you talk about that, because I'm constantly talking to young athletes about it. You know, when they have an ankle injury or shoulder injury, they're like, I'm fine. You know, a week later, I'm like, listen, and you try to give them the trajectory of the retrospective, you know, talk like a parent.
Yeah.
And they look at you like you're nuts. And I said, you know, come to the clinic one day and see some of these patients that have knee replacements or hip replacements or shoulder replacements even. And they sometimes they're like, oh, yeah, I kind of get it. But, you know, the kids are kids. But we can do what we can try to do now, like you said, the preventative piece, and try to make sure we're making the right decisions to send them back when they're safe to go back so they don't get hurt any further. So
exactly. And one thing I like about your approach in particular, because it's the same as ours, people forget that there's massive benefits to participating in sports. So everybody today, people talk about the injuries and all the risks associated. Well, of course that's there, but that is the downside of getting the benefits, you know, and there's nothing worse than sitting on a couch all day playing video games. Like you,
exactly.
For your health now, it's bad for your health long-term. Like there's just no way around it. So I try to strike a good balance.
Yeah. And you know, we talk about the mental component of being part of an athletic program or being an athlete in general, being with your peers. Even with athletes, when we see injuries, I try to keep them involved on the team, even if they're injured. So for them, if they have an ankle injury, they can go out and help teach the younger kids or even some of their peers their position and not be on the field. Or they can be there if they haven't, you know, if they have a shoulder injury, they can maybe kick balls to the goalie to help your goalie warm up. So there can be beneficial ways to keep them mentally engaged, so we don't go that other direction. And you mentioned earlier, having behavioral therapists or sports psychologists in the center.
That's right.
There's that side of it, right? We deal with all the time and people don't look at those things, but the mental health component.
Exactly.
Can you speak a little bit to that? How do you guys deal with the mental health, and is that expanding in your center? And is there more people that are worried about that return, or is it about the same?
For sure. So we have two levels of it. So we have a mental skills specialist. And that really does stuff that's not clinical anxiety or clinical depression, but really specifically related to sports. So maybe they have some performance anxiety they're trying to get through, or maybe for the last 3 weeks they haven't been able to hit a fastball, and they're like, "It's something's going on in here." You know,
right. Chuck Knobloch couldn't feel the ball.
That's taking me back, right? Yeah. So that just that kind of stuff, and they say, "Okay, well, what can we do to improve that?" And you know, what is your self talk like? And she's excellent. Kelsey Griffiths is her name.
Yeah, Kelsey's great.
Yeah. And then we have Emily Pluhar, who is a clinical psychologist. So she deals with people who are suffering from clinical anxiety or depression. And often that does change when they're injured. You know, if you tear your ACL, you're missing a year of sports. And, and some of our patients will tear it, and then they get surgery. They go back, they tear the other one, you know, or they tear the surgical graft. And you can imagine the toll that takes on them. And so Emily's been fantastic for helping my patients with that. And then the demand was so great that we just hired Taryn Brandt, who fortunately for us does both. So she is a clinical psychologist who also does the mental skills. We've expanded she just started a couple months ago. And I suspect there'll probably be more hires in the future. The other thing that's happening, and you probably see this in where you are, but you know, some injuries get a lot of attention in the media and people learn about them. Of course, what you learn in the media is never the straight shot. It's always exaggerated. It's always embellished. And there's a lot of kids who are suffering from undue anxiety, unnecessary anxiety after their injuries. And I think our clinical psychologists in particular are great at helping manage that,
because,
you know, that's crippling. It doesn't go away unless you fix it.
Yeah, I think it's a great component. And I'm going to be doing some episodes on mental health. I got to actually reach out to Kelsey, because, you know, I've talked to her a bunch of times, and I think she'd be great to discuss kind of the piece of, you know, stepping back into the performance realm, right? Because that person, I was talking to a patient the other day about it, or actually an athlete. You know, when you have an injury, it's stepping back over that sideline, you know, from the spectator to the athlete, you know, and how do you embrace that and not think about your previous injury and play at the level you need to play at so you don't get injured again.
That's right.
And I think that's an important piece. But then you, like you talked about the anxiety, depression piece, or even some of that clinical stuff.
Yeah.
That's more important, where kids just get into that. And this is going to lead into the next discussion. I think, you know, concussion, like, you know, this has gotten, you know, the press, it's gotten everybody that is probably been in the profession the last 15 years or more. I think the press that it has, where it's been, where it's going, and where do we think it's, you know, the future of it is as far as care goes. You wrote a, you know, a book about it, and has done, you've done a lot, ton of research on it. What was it that intrigued you and kind of pulled you into that direction?
Yeah.
That kind of put you as the, you know, yourself and I think Dr. O'Brien as the go-tos over there at the McKaley Center.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it was a patient. So this is what's great about working at an academic medical center is your patients bring questions to you. You try to investigate them, and then you can bring the answers back to the patient. So I was working in the ER at the time, and a young woman came in, a professional athlete, figure skater. And she had been in a motor vehicle collision and got a concussion. Now, this had happened maybe 6 weeks before she came to the ER. She had a lot of injuries, as you might imagine, but most of them were better, but she was still suffering from a concussion. And she came in simply trying to find a doctor to manage her. She said, I don't really have an emergency, but I can't find someone to help me with this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the time, I thought, this is Boston Children's. We got someone who does everything. So I called around, and it turned out we didn't really have anyone doing it. You know, Pierre Demicourt was here, and he was taking care of sport-related concussions.
Yeah.
But this young lady got one in a motor vehicle collision. And at the time, neurologists were not take care of concussions very often. And neurosurgery would do it some places, but it's non-surgical injury. And so mm-hmm. they sort of felt like, well, what are we doing this for, you know? And so it was hard to find her care. And so I started reading about it mostly to help her. You know, I would call her primary care doctor. I was a fellow at the time. And I would say, hey, I read this article. You might want to try this. But the more I read, the more fascinated I got. And it was around that time I was interviewing for sports medicine fellowship. And I met with Dr. McGailey, and during my interview, now I got a year and a half left of ER fellowship, yeah. Right? But I said to him, listen, I think you should start a sports concussion clinic, because I think there's a need out there from the patients I see in the ER. It'd only been a handful at that point. And Pierre was the fellowship director. And so I said, okay, you know, that was my pitch. Well, anyway, Pierre calls me that night, the night that I interviewed. I got a year and a half of ER fellowship before sports would start, even if I got in. And Pierre says, listen, Dr. McKaley loved your idea. In fact, he's wondering, can you start on Thursday? and so I met with Rich Bacher, who was head of the ER at the time, the ER fellowship at the time. And I told him, I said, look, can I get a day off a week, like from ER? Like, I'll do the same number of ER shifts, but can you schedule it around one day a week where I could do this concussion thing?
Yeah.
And he said, sure. And so we didn't start that Thursday. We started the following Tuesday. All of a sudden, Pierre and I were seeing concussion patients, and it just, maybe a year after that, the media started drawing a lot of attention to it, and all of a sudden it blew up. And now most of our providers take care of concussion patients. The clinic's led by Mike O'Brien, is a great director. He's just clinically on top of it. And it's gone beyond that. So now Mike O'Brien is a big part of what Children's has, what's called the multidisciplinary concussion clinic. And this is for people who got a concussion and down the line, they're having a lot of problems that probably aren't concussion anymore. And so we bring together neurologists, sports medicine physicians, neuropsychologists, optometrists, ophthalmologists, vestibular specialists, an ENT physician, as well as a physical therapist with specialty in vestibular, a sports psychologist sometimes. I hope I'm not forgetting anybody, but and they do a full comprehensive assessment. It takes a few hours.
Yeah.
But most of the time they find this, look, it's something else going on. You no longer have a concussion. And it's super helpful, because I think a lot of times people just keep getting told it's your concussion. Just wait, you know, but
right.
You do that, you're not going to get any better. And so,
right.
So it's good. It's good how it evolved.
Yeah. I mean, you and I have talked about this, I think, in length. I mean, the patients I typically would refer out are those ones that aren't getting better. Like, something's not right here. Like, what's usually these kids get better when we start to do light exercise and try to integrate them back in, because we know there's so much crossover between the psychological piece of concussion or injury and being, you know, removed from a sport or from your group to the concussion, right? So there can be some anxiety, depression, some sleep disturbances, all that stuff that we normally will see.
Yeah.
But the telltale symptoms usually typically go away, like your headaches, your dizziness, your other vestibular stuff will tend to go away. But this other stuff kind of lingers. That's when we make the call and say, hey, you know, something else might be going on here. Can we take a deeper dive into this? And you guys have been really good with that.
Yeah, we try to do it. And But I don't know that I've ever sent someone to the multidisciplinary concussion clinic who came back with, oh, it's still concussion.
Which is a good thing. Yeah.
It's a great thing because, you know, nobody's treating the other stuff. They just keep saying it's concussion. You got to find it, treat it, and the kids get better. And it's
right. Great. And, you know, quite frankly, some of those athletes or even, you know, adolescents or adults that, you know, they could have had, you know, whiplash injury. No one treated their cervical spine and they're getting symptoms, right? And no one's looking at that. And that's the other thing that we, I guess, kind of oversee and overlook.
Yeah.
Or really overlook, not oversee, but I think understanding the total person and really getting drilling down to that, you know, pretty much the organic piece of it. So yeah. What have you, so over the past, it's probably more than 15 years, I just kind of, yeah. I think time just keeps speeding up on us. I feel like the last year went by like it was 10 seconds, but
yeah, you're not kidding, it's
at least 15 plus years. Like what have we learned? Like, I think concussion in general, like if you looked at the timeline,
yeah.
What have we learned in the since you started to now? I mean, I think probably the first concussion symposium was it before you started this or was it sure right was. After?
No, it was before. It was before. Okay. I went when I was a fellow. I went and attended it, and it was already on the third or fourth at that point.
It used to be at Gillette. It was Gillette, I think. Right?
Fenway.
Oh, was Park. It Fenway, and then it moved? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, that was the first conference I spoke at. Was at Fenway Park. They invited me after 2 or 3 years, and it was great. Yeah, you know, it's interesting in some ways. We've learned a lot. In some ways, we haven't learned squat. It's really fascinating. So I would say of the things we've learned, the change in management is a big one. So initially, it was all based on expert opinion. Mm-hmm. And this before my time. And the experts would say, well, look, when athletes have a concussion, if they exercise, it makes their headaches worse. So let's tell them not to do that.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes if they're doing a lot of schoolwork or studying, it makes them feel worse. So let's tell them not to do that. And it was good advice because most people got better in a week or two anyway, and then you went back and everything was fine. But as the media, I think, started paying more attention to this, people's duration of symptoms go longer and longer and longer and longer. And I'll come back to that because I think there's a reason for that research wise. But and then you had these people who weren't exercising at all. So they'd come to see Pierre and I. Like, they've been 3 months. They've been laying in the dark bed every day, not moving, you know, just
like a vampire.
Yeah. And of course, the recommendation was that's what they should be doing. You know, they weren't doing anything wrong. You know, I just think when they came out with that recommendation, I don't think any of them envisioned how far people were going to take it, you know, other doctors and patients and everything else. And of course, if you just laid in bed all day for weeks on end, you'd feel miserable too. Like, that's just not healthy. And so I suppose the biggest change and that we've learned is, look, when you have a concussion, you should still exercise, you know, do as much as you can tolerate without feeling worse. And every few days, try to do a little bit more,
right?
Keep going to school, keep going to work. Like, don't end your life because it's just going to make it worse. And I would say the biomechanics are pretty clear. You know, there's some rapid rotational acceleration of the brain that results in concussion. I think that's pretty clear and it's been demonstrated well in the last few years. However, the pathophysiology, like what's happening at a cellular level, we have no idea. Mm-hmm. Now, I give a talk where I talk about the leading hypothesis, but the truth is that was based on animal models in which we remove part of the skull, we hook a syringe up to the hole that we made in the skull and hit the plunger, right? It's got saline in half of it. You hit the plunger and it sends a fluid wave across the brain. Well, whether or not that's the same thing that happens when you get hit in the chin and your head spins, we have no idea.
Yeah.
Even the cumulative effects of concussion, I would say it's pretty clear that there are cumulative effects. You see this in the animal modeling and clinical data demonstrates that. But what they are, how much is attributable to the concussions, and even the mechanism by which you go from having isolated injuries to chronic effects, we just have no idea. And I think that's the importance of laboratory work. You know, you're never going to figure that out in people, so you have to have animal modeling. So, you know, we've learned a lot, but there's a lot we don't know still. And what drives me crazy when I hear people say, well, and given what we know about concussion, I feel like, oh, I do spend my whole life on this issue and I don't know anything about it. Like, it's a mystery. We haven't made as big a dent as the public thinks we have.
Yeah. And do you think, does functional MRI have a place? I mean, is that something it's been talked about, right? I haven't looked into the research about it, but I know that there was a lot of talk about it several years ago about it being kind of the next wave. Or even, is there biomarkers that we can look at? How does that play into evaluating and treating?
Yeah. So functional MRI, I think it was the hot topic. Even when I was just starting out, that was what everybody thought the future would be. And I think it's useful for research. I think clinically it's not super helpful yet. And and realistically, you know, we're going to get a functional MRI and every kid that has a concussion, like it's a, It's a lengthy procedure. It costs a lot of money. There's just think how many
a lot of wasted healthcare dollars.
Totally for nothing. You're not learning it. You already knew they had a concussion. Now you get this. Exactly. So I'm not sure it's going to be helpful in that regard, but for teaching this mechanism, maybe, you know, so I think it's useful as a research tool. I think biomarkers have potential. So, you know, there's some early biomarkers that clearly are different between athletes who have a concussion and not. Some of them that we've studied here, Matt Eisenberg and Rebecca Mannix in the ER here studied GFAP, which is one of the sort of more well-known ones. And the higher it was when you showed up in the ER, the longer your duration of symptoms. And I think there's probably some biomarkers for potential cumulative effects or long-term chronic effects. So I think it's early. It's in early stages, but I think probably there's some potential there.
Yeah. You know, I talked to athlete trainers about this, and I think everybody, it's interesting. The standard of care for us is obviously however you want to sideline evaluate somebody. What I tend to do is, I mean, we used to always use the SAC, then the SCAT and the SCAT 19, whatever is now. I think there's a SCAT 6. It's like 7 pages long. And I'm like, the time it's going to take me to do that. And we've been using vestibulocular screening, which has been very successful in us predicting, do they have an injury? Do they not? Because we know potential injury is there, right? We saw it, we watched it, unless they came in a clinic and we didn't see them get injured. They're reporting subjective information you're getting from the patient or reporting of symptoms is just their subjective reporting, right? So I think it's knowing the athlete. I think you probably have a harder job as the, you know, physician seeing the patient for the first time versus, and you usually will bounce back. So just you and I relationship wise, when I would send someone to you or if someone else you work with is an athlete trainer, the conversations we have been, when you know that they are given the testing you're doing, if you're going to use any type of neurocognitive testing as a tool, great. But you know the athlete better than probably the neurocognitive testing. So yeah. I think knowing them, knowing what they're like traditionally, you can make a pretty good clinical decision given your return to play protocol. And that if you're doing the steps the way that you should be return to play, then, you know, the likelihood of re-injury for them is going to be less than if someone just said, oh yeah, in a week when your headache goes away, go back to sports.
Well, I think that's key for a lot of reasons. And actually the symptoms of concussion are mostly nonspecific. You know, a lot of things will give you difficulty concentrating, interfere with your sleep, give you a headache. I mean, it's not just concussion. And even the neuropsychological testing, it's affected not just by concussion, but also how much sleep you got. How motivated are you to take it? Mm-hmm. Are you sad because your girlfriend dumped you? Like, you know, a lot of things are affecting it. And so you really need to interpret it. The better you know the athlete, the easier it is, I think, to interpret some of those things.
Yeah, and we kind of hit home on is know your athletes, know what they're like, talk to their parents, talk to their teachers, like have a really good holistic approach and make a great clinical decision. And if you can't, that's when you would refer out. And even then, the physician's going to probably say the same thing, like, hey, let's get you back to exercise and see how things go. So,
yeah, a lot of times you free up the restrictions on kids after a concussion, they get better.
Yeah. You
know, I think a lot of it is we caused it by the recommendations we had in place over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. When you look back to your journey as a physician, like going through your, you know, even at BC, like, did you have, we talk about mentorship and how important that is at whatever level that may be. You know, you could have a mentor as a high school athlete and you have a coach that's a mentor to you, right? Or a teacher.
Sure.
How do you value that? And what was it that helped you? Or did you, you know, as far as mentors go, once you became a physician or were moving through fellowship, who are those people? And do you still go to those people for, you know, advice, conversation, bounce things off of?
I sure do. Man, I'm so glad you asked me because this is like super important to me. So I actually had no interest in research until really late. So when I was an emergency medicine fellow, I wasn't going to do research. I was just going to practice emergency medicine. And Rich Bacher, who is now the chief of emergency medicine, he said, look, you got to do it for your fellowship. And here's a project I think you could work on. And so I worked with Rich, who's still a mentor to me today. And he really fired up my interest in research. And while that was going on, Rebecca Mannix, who was my chief resident and then my chief fellow in emergency medicine, said, listen, there's a guy over at MGH doing animal models of brain injury. Why don't you try a concussion one? So I went over to Mike Whalen at MGH and he was a super mentor. And him and Rebecca still, so now Rich Bacher, her mate, still mentor me. Then Dr. McKaylee, right? Calling, having Pierre call me the night I interviewed and said, hey, let's And then he gave me some, him and I edited a book for clinics and sports medicine. And he's just continues to be a great mentor to me. Mickey Collins down at the University of Pittsburgh. He was an early mentor to me. He was great to me when I was a fellow. I told him what I was interested in. And he let me fly down there and work with them for, I think it was three or four days anyway, and see how they did it in Pittsburgh and take it back. And he wrote a few papers with me when I came back. I had a research project going. He really mentored me through that. And I still talk to Mick every now and then, but I just think he's a great guy and he was really good to me. And Martha Murray, who's chief of orthopedics now, she was on my my fellowship scholarly oversight committee for my laboratory research. Mm-hmm. And then now, because I still get mentored. So I work with Kevin Goskowitz, who's sort of well-known athletic trainer and a PhD. Yep. Ruben Eshimendia and Mike McRae, who are neuropsychologists, who, you know, I read their books on concussion when I was learning about it back when I was an ER fellow. And they still mentor me now. We have a great project together, an NFL long study we can talk about later, but they mentor me on that. Dr. Coker, Waters, Proctor, Mannix again, Gary Fleischer, who's physician in chief here, Peter Lawson, they all mentor me on my career choices. Tom Mayer, who's the medical director for the NFLPA, has mentored me a ton since we've met. And then, God rest his soul, Tom Menino was my first real job out of college.
Yeah.
And he mentored me throughout. So maybe less than a year before he died, him and Angela and my wife and I went out for dinner, and he said to me, "Listen, Billy, you know, you don't want to be just a doctor. You want to be head of a group of doctors, right? You're running this injury prevention center, whatever."
Yeah.
And he talked me into going back to business school. You know, he's a big part of that. And
it's good.
So I still rely on him. And then Lee Nadler, who's dean of clinical and translational research for Harvard, I wrote big grant with him and Alvaro Pasqualioni and Ross Safant early in my career. And it was a humongous grant. And I learned a ton from Dr. Nadler about how to write grants and how to put them together and work them. So, and then there's people I go to for one-offs. So Sandy Fenwick, who was former CEO here, I was lucky enough that she agreed to go out for a cup of coffee with me and give me some great career advice about how to move forward in the hospital and hospital leadership. Howard Grant, who was head of Lehigh Hospital, did the same thing for me. I offered to take him out for a steak, and I never met him. I cold emailed him, and he says, "Actually, I'm a vegetarian, but come by the office and, and we'll talk."
Some hummus.
Yeah, right. And Betsy Nabel, who is CEO at the Brigham, same deal. I offered to take her out for a steak. She says, "Come by the office. I'll buy you breakfast." You know, Jim Mandel, who's former CEO of Children's, did the same thing. Took me out for breakfast, and so I just have a ton of mentors, and I still rely on them regularly. You know, a few times a year for some, and with Rebecca Mannix, multiple times a week.
Yeah,
you know?
I think Rebecca would be upset if you didn't mention her.
Yeah, I think I mentioned her four times now. So
exactly.
Hopefully. But
she's
a great person.
Our
nurse, oh, she's excellent.
She is very, very nice, and she does a great job too. I don't know how she still does the emergency medicine stuff.
Yeah, well, she does. That's her real thing. You know, that's what she does mostly, really. And she's just amazing. But they're all amazing. They all have helped me. And a lot of the guys I mentioned, a lot of the women and men, they are really way above me. You know what I mean? Like the Gary Fleischer, physician in chief of the hospital. But when I reach out to him, he calls me back right away and he helps me out. And I didn't know Betsy Nabel. She was CEO of the Brigham, but she says, "Sure, you know, come on over." So they're just super generous. Howard Grant, like I told you, so super. Mark Proctor, chief of neurosurgery, helps me all the time. I had an issue and I was at his house two nights ago. He said, "Come by the backyard and we'll chat." You know, they're just so willing to help. So I'm blessed in that way.
It's great to hear that, because, you know, I try to ask everybody that comes on the show about mentorship, because I think it's very important. It's how we grow. It's how we become better at what we do every day. It's how we learn. It's how they learn. And you know, I ran into the same thing. You know, I first took my job out of college, was I started working for Carl, and I think that was probably one of the best decisions of my life. I mean, he's one of my biggest mentors. You know, I go to him all the time. I was just texting him this morning. I'm like, "Hey, Weston's playing at Medfield tonight. Swing by, you can be a sideline chief with me." And he goes, "I might see you later on," you know? So I think that, and you know, all the people I've had contact with over time, even you, you know, you as a physician talking to you about things, I consider you a mentor in the field that you're, you know, dealing with the athletes that I'm sending over to you guys. So I feel like there's always that way to grow and get better and learn. And if you don't, you become stagnant, and you know, it just becomes not great for you professionally. But
exactly.
I think I'd had the same interaction. Our CEO for the company, for ATI, I had met her. She was CVS Health, worked for CVS Health as a CEO for them, and then left and came to us. And I had bumped into her. She came by the clinic to say hi one day, and then I met her. We were coming back from a leadership convention, and we were talking at the airport. She goes, "Hey, are you going back to the clinic?" It was like on a Sunday we were coming back. And I said, "Well, yeah, I left my car." She's like, "You want to share an Uber?" I'm like, "Sure." So her and I had like a half hour of FaceTime in the car. And I said, "You know, would you like to get together and have a cup of coffee? I'd like to pick your brain about where the company's going and what your, you know, what your future is for the company." Yeah. I said, "Absolutely." Yeah. So just asking those questions. And like you said, they're above you. Like, this is the CEO of a massive company
yeah.
that I don't know more than 10 minutes. And she's, you know, agreeing to sit down and have coffee and hear what I have to say on how we're doing and what I want to know about the future. So,
I'll tell you, when I was early in research, when I was just starting that big grant I talked about that I did with Dr. Nadler, the Herman Taylor is a physician and he ran something called the Jackson Heart Study. So everybody talks about the Framingham Heart Study.
Yeah. But my wife's a part of the Framingham Heart Study.
Is that right? Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing, right? So it's huge. Think of how much we've learned from the Framingham Heart Study. But of course, it's mostly white people. Yeah. And Herman said, "Hey, man, we should do something for African-American people." So he set up the Jackson Heart Study, and it's in rural Mississippi, and it's a different population. And it's humongous, and they're learning a ton for it. And he was coming to give grand rounds at Boston Children's, and I'd met him. And so on a whim, I sent him an email saying, "Hey, I'm sure you're wicked busy, but if you get time, I'd love to take you out for a cup of coffee or for dinner or something, and just we can chat and whatever." And he says, "Actually, I'm not busy. I'm showing up at noon to give grand rounds." So I said, "Why don't we go out for dinner the night before?" So I got about 2.5-3 hours one-on-one with the guy who's running one of the biggest cohort studies around, and we're still friends. And you know, he gives me advice from time to time. It's just super helpful. So yeah, it's the opportunities like that some people don't seize. I think they're missing out.
Well, the interesting thing is, if you decide to retire from medicine, I know you have a career in politics because you can talk to anybody, right? And you, again, your mentor, Dr. Mayor Menino, right?
Yeah.
We do, you know, maybe, I don't know, mayor for you, governor, president. I don't know. I'd vote for you.
Thanks, man. Yeah. Before I knew I could go back and do a post-bac pre-med program, that was the plan I was going to stay in.
Well, there's always a second career, too.
Like, yeah, you never know. I loved it. I mean, I had some great mentors there, Menino and Michael Knievy, and it was a great job. I'm still in touch with the people I worked with then, too, and we go out maybe once a year or something, but yeah.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, we'll see.
We just need a new city hall.
Yeah, right? You were stepping in one of the biggest controversies of the last 50 years with that, my friend.
What do you like to do in your free time? What's you mentioned outdoors with the family and the kids. Like, what's your free time go to? What do you like to do?
That's the big one. So I play with my kids all the time. Yeah. And awesome. And mostly we go outdoors. We go fishing and canoeing and hiking and camping and backpacking. And my wife and kids, we like playing games. Lately, we've been playing Quirkle and Dominoes and Awari and sort of the classic games like that. And I'm a Cub Scout den leader for all three of my kids. So I run three of them.
With all your free time, right?
Yeah. It's not too bad. It's a couple times a month and it's super fun. I play a little bit of traditional Irish music. So my grandparents are from Ireland, and I play an instrument called the timber flute, and play reels and jigs and that kind of stuff. In fact, I was playing last night for the first time in a while. And I like exercising. You know, as I get older, it's hard for me to exercise for the sake of exercising. So I find it hard to lift anymore. I just can't motivate. And I used to run. I have trouble motivating for that. But I'll bike, like commute. You know, I'll commute my bicycle to get some exercise. And I've been learning some martial arts, and I've been exercising that way, which is exhausting, by the way.
Yeah, you spar for
5 minute rounds, you're just drenched and sweating, exhausted in the end. So,
yeah, the exercise piece is interesting because I mean, we probably hold close to the same hours in a day, but I get up at 4 and work out, walk down to the basement, work out, try to get to the clinic at 6, and then, you know, grind during the day. So it can be very daunting, but just trying to keep it going. You know, family time too. I mean, my wife and I's daughter, our daughter, she always says when something goes wrong, this is always, I don't know if this happens in your house.
Yeah.
When my daughter does something wrong, it's your daughter, right? Your daughter. Yeah. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's our daughter, first of all. And I know I always say it's your gene pool. I always throw it back at her.
Yeah.
So yeah, we have a great relationship, but our daughter is, in her second year of grad school. So she's, you know, she's, I think you and I might have talked about this. She's in speech and language pathology, graduate degree, second year. She just started her externship at Inova Healthcare in Fairfax, Virginia, and she's working with adult stroke patients and, you know, traumatic brain. Loves it. Like, fell in love with it. Loves the neuro piece and is just very happy that she's doing it. She just said yesterday she had a patient 2 days ago that was actually, unfortunately, like a a meth addict and had was in a catatonic state, and just this whole like her amazement of the patient and the ability to be able to get them the speech language pathologist took an ice cube, and there was no response from the patient with any verbal or visual cues.
Yeah.
They took an ice cube and put it on his lips, and he turned his head and opened his eyes wide. Just with that tactile touch of the ice cube, my daughter was like blown away. She's like, that is amazing.
It is a great way to earn a living. If you like people and you like talking to people stuff, healthcare is a great way to earn a living. And it seems like, you know, she's found her calling.
I think she's got the bug. We'll see.
Exactly.
She better. It's expensive.
It is, but it's still worth it. I mean, it's such a great way to earn a living.
What's the fun fact about Dr. Meehan?
I like to shoot marbles. That would be, really? Oh man, I love shooting marbles. It is like, I'm obsessed with it. So my kids and when COVID first hit, we were looking for stuff to do. You know, this is before you knew, can you go hang out with people or whatever? And Amazon suggested to me, you might like a tin of marbles, right? I said, well, that's interesting. So I bought the tin of marbles. Of course, I had no idea how to play.
Yeah.
So I got some books, and then I started watching some videos. I went to some websites, and I probably read now probably 30 books on marbles.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not. I'm totally
I didn't think it was that expensive.
Oh my goodness. And I have tons of them. Just this past weekend, the kids and I played 7 hours worth of marbles. And
really?
There's a game they play in Kentucky and Tennessee on what's called a marble yard. It looks like a big bocce court. It's 40 feet long. It's 25 feet wide. And they play this game called Roly Hole. And I don't have that much land, but I built a marble yard in my front yard. It's 20 feet long. It's 10 feet wide. And the kids and I play. And I would say if any of your listeners are local and they want to know how to shoot or they want
I'm going to come by.
Come by and
I'll bring the Guinness or the Bushmills, whatever you want.
I have marbles and I will travel and I will play anyone, anytime, anywhere. I just am totally obsessed with it. So
I think that's an invitation. I'll have to come by. I think I can probably pull a few people you know over there.
Bring them, Brad. Bring them by. Bring Carl. In fact, you can come. You could book it now. Good Friday. Every Good Friday is World Marbles Day. They have a big tournament.
Is it really?
Yes. And I host a marbles party here at the McKaylee Center. So you trip over from Weston, you're going to take knock out of work early. And during your lunch hour, you come shoot some marbles with us.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
I never knew. I knew dominoes is a big thing, like playing dominoes, but marbles I didn't think was a big thing.
I'm determined to bring it back. It's the best game on earth. I don't know how we lost sight of that as a country.
So where's the lineage? Like where did it come from?
So marbles, the oldest game known to mankind. In fact, in King Tut's tomb, there was a bag of marbles.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They've been around since before Christ, although I guess that you can't say that PC now, but you know,
right.
Whatever you're supposed to say has been around exactly. Longer than that, you know. And it was played during the Civil War. Soldiers would carry a little pouch with marbles on them, and they would play everywhere. Abraham Lincoln was an excellent marbles player. He specialized in a game called Old Bowler, which I play with my kids.
I'll wear my Abe Lincoln socks when I come.
There you go. It has had such a role in life that we don't realize. Like a lot of expressions that we say every day come from the playing of marbles, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, what's the quick version of how do you, like, what's the end of a game of marbles? Like,
the typical game, and the one they play at the U.S. National Marbles Tournament, which is the week after Father's Day every year in June, is called Ringer. And there's a big circle. The tournament, it's 10 feet in diameter, but most of the time you play with something smaller. And you put a certain amount of marbles in. For the tournament, it's 13. And then you have a shooter marble, which is a little bigger. So the target marbles are called mids. Your shooter is a little bit bigger.
Oh, you got it in your hand.
I have them in my pocket everywhere I go. Oh, in case I come upon a game, I got to be ready to play. You know,
awesome.
Oh, yeah. And you try to knock the marbles out of the ring. And if there's 13, the first person to knock out 7 wins that game. And then you play. And traditionally, when you're kids, you play for keeps. So you would bring your big bag of marbles. And any marble you knock out of the ring, that's yours now.
I gotcha.
But that's one game. That's the easy, quick game. But there's so many other games. And they get more and more fun the better you get and the more you learn.
All right. Well, game on. When I talk to Carl, I'm going to tell him. He probably knows. You probably talk to him about it all the time.
He's been to World Marbles Day. He shot a few rounds.
Nice.
I think he was there this year and 2 years ago. So he called.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. I'll put it on my calendar.
Do it, man.
Hey, Bill, thanks. I appreciate everything, especially taking time out of your day. This is an awesome talk. And I hope people get, you know, some valuable information out of it. If anybody wants to come over and see you guys at the McKinley Center, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Oh, just give us a call or come to the website. If you go to the website, you can even book appointments online on the website, or give us a call or send us an email. It's easy.
Awesome.
It's easy. Everything's on the website. And listen, thanks for doing this, Riz. I like what you're doing with this podcast. I think it's important. And
that's awesome. I do appreciate it. Tell everybody over there I said hello. I'll come by and visit soon.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right, my man. Take care.
All right. Thank you for tuning in to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we're committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed today's episode, give us a like, comment, and share it on social media. Access all of our episodes on platforms such as Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast app. Stay updated by following us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or visiting our website at ajrsportsscience.podbean.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science for upcoming content. Thank you for tuning in, and stay tuned for our next episode.